This is the second day of this December 2014 four-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text, which is an anthology of teachings, short selections of teachings from about a dozen great Chinese masters. The book is called Zen Essence. It's translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. We left off yesterday having just begun with Zen Master Da Wei, who was born in the 11th century, died in the 12th century. And he begins quoting a folk saying from China: don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't mind another's business. That's the saying. And then he says, although this is a common saying, it can also help you penetrate Zen. Just examine yourself constantly, from morning to night. What have you done that is beneficial to others and to yourself? If you notice any partiality, you should alert yourself and not overlook it. Well, this is not a practice that I've ever heard recommended, asking yourself, what have you done that's beneficial to others and to yourself? We want to go beyond such thoughts. And naturally, it could be of some benefit to, in terms of measuring our how self-absorbed we are, how selfish we are. But ultimately, in Zen, we want to get beyond measuring of ourselves and others. The larger point, though, is where he says in the last sentence, if you notice any partiality. Another translation for this is self-partiality, which really means self-concern or self-centeredness. And that is something we need to be mindful of. When it is that we are acting out of self-centeredness. And that kind of mindfulness does come through sustained practice. We catch ourselves more readily when we're just grasping at something out of our own self-interest. Another way of understanding this is don't busy yourself with other people's business. Don't interfere with others. Don't judge other people. Just attend to your own faults, your own self-concerns. Notice those things. Zen practice is a practice of noticing. Most people just blindly blunder through their days and years, just acting out of self-interest as though it were just, there's no other way. Of course, you just look after yourself. But we can do better than that, we human beings. Here's another one. He starts with a quote: when you have no mind, Zen is easy to find. And then he goes on to say, in Zen terminology, no-mindedness does not mean insensitivity or ignorance. It means that the mind is stable and does not get stirred up by the situations and circumstances one encounters. It means the mind does not grasp anything. It is clear in all situations, unimpeded and undefiled, not dwelling on anything, even on non-defilement. I think this word no-mindedness is unique to Zen. It's not what we usually refer to as mindlessness. Mindlessness is just inattention. No-mindedness is where the mind is not caught in thought. It's open, free, responsive. No-mindedness is what great athletes function in when they're playing at their best. It's beyond strategizing. It's just unimpeded, free functioning, where thoughts, one is not caught in the manacles of thought. It's a very advanced state. And it is its own reward, this state of freedom from thoughts. I'm convinced that's why athletes are willing to train so rigorously for so long in order to access this realm of no mind. It's also sometimes called reaching the zone, reaching a flow. This is something that we don't need to rely on a particular activity like an athletic activity or sport. Through Zen, we have the ability over time to train the mind to function in this no-minded state, little by little, more and more. It's just the most exhilarating state, and one that I'm sure everyone in his life has experienced at some time, maybe many times, through sports or through music or other things. This is a way of finding zest in life, but we don't have to bind ourselves to any particular activity, such as sports or music, but we can learn to enjoy that in the most ordinary kind of circumstances by being fully attentive to where we are, being fully present. That's no-mindedness. We can't be present and dwelling in our thoughts at the same time. Here's another selection from Da Wei's teaching. Good and bad come from your own mind. But what do you call your own mind, apart from your actions and thoughts? Where does your own mind come from? If you really know where your own mind comes from, boundless obstacles caused by your own actions will be cleared all at once. After that, all sorts of extraordinary possibilities will come to you without your seeking them. Most Westerners, if you ask them where is your mind, they will point to their head. As Westerners, we tend to identify the mind with the discursive intellect, the discriminating mind. But that's a very limited way of understanding mind. The Buddha famously said the following about mind and body. I declare to you that in this very body, though only 6 feet in length, but conscious and endowed with mind, are the world and the origin of the world and the ceasing of the world, and likewise the way that leads to the ceasing thereof. If you think there are any verbal formulations that are special, mysterious secrets to be transmitted, this is not real Zen. Real Zen has no transmission. It is just a matter of people experiencing it, resulting in their ability to see each other's vision and communicate tacitly. As always, we have to take anyone's words with a grain of salt here. When he says real Zen has no transmission, of course we know there is this tradition in Zen of what we call Dharma transmission. But when he says real Zen, he means the essence of Zen. The essence of Zen is beyond this and that. And if it's beyond this and that, it's beyond transmission. Transmission implies going from this to that. In real Zen, there's just this. Just this. This moment. This place. Here. Now. And then it's up to us to experience this moment. Moment after moment. Many people who practice Zen are in a burning rush to learn Zen when their worldly affairs are not to their satisfaction, but then give up Zen when they become successful in the world. Well, things haven't changed all that much. People with a less than deep aspiration for the Dharma will find that when things are not going their way, they're more interested in, well, basically it's self-improvement. That's what's underneath that is, how do I become happier? And that's fair enough. I think I would guess that the majority of us, when we come to Zen practice, we just want to find a way out of our suffering. And then it's only time that will tell whether there's something deeper, something truly spiritual underneath that. You also see it sometimes in romance that people from time to time, someone will come to Zen from the pain of a breakup in a relationship or divorce, and they will practice with the commitment of someone who wants to find a way out of that pain. But then, sometimes the person will strike up with another in another relationship, and then that sort of eclipses the practice. They don't feel the need for it anymore. And there's nothing that anyone can do about that. That's just the way things are. It comes down to what it is we want from practice, what it is that we need from practice. If it's just to, as a kind of a balm or a salve for a temporary pain that we're going through, well, all right. Sure, it can be used that way. But if there is a genuine need to understand one's nature and understand the nature of life and death, then that will be more of a sustained motivation, and it won't be affected in any big way by periods of happiness. It's in the end, it's just kind of really a matter of our karma. Has our karma with Zen or spiritual practice, has it ripened to the point where it's something we need to see through the worldly fortunes and misfortunes? If so, then the ups and downs aren't going to derail us from practice. Sometimes wonder how often in ancient China or Japan, how often people came to practice out of poverty, because they really had nothing in this world. And having realized that there is nothing we can cling to, nothing ultimately that we can keep for ourselves, they came to the Dharma. I don't think that's a motivation I can remember ever seeing, that people come here now in the West. People come to practice just because they have nothing left. Nothing in a physical sense, a material sense. But much of the history of Zen saw periods of famine and poverty that we can hardly even imagine. When you have attained mental and physical peace and quiet, don't get stuck in peace and quiet. Be independent and free, like a gourd rolling and bobbing on a river. That second sentence, be independent and free, like a gourd on a river, implies that peace and quiet is something we can be stuck in. We're not free if we're attached to peace and quiet in our zazen. I think it's common in our culture to associate the word Zen with peace and quiet, with calm. But Zen offers so much more than just being calm or quiet. The stillness that we can develop through zazen, that stillness can become a very serious attachment. It can leave us practicing Zen just as a relaxation method. just a way to settle down, soothe our nerves after a busy day or a busy week. It's better than nothing. Better to practice like that for those reasons than for nothing. But it's such a measly kind of aspiration just to use it as a kind of a cocktail. Stillness and peace of mind can become a kind of spell that we fall under. The great Zen Master Hakuin warned about this over and over, of getting stuck in the honey sweetness of peace and quiet. That's nothing at all like awakening to our true nature, seeing through birth and death. My guess is that most people these days who practice Zen, most people do so to relax. Otherwise, I think we'd see even more people coming to Sesshin than we do see. So, using it as a relaxation method can last a longer or shorter time, and then it may develop into something greater than that. And most likely, it's more likely to change if we get hit by some kind of a crisis, a loss in our lives. That's what sometimes it takes to have us step up our practice into something more than a way of relaxing. But Sesshin itself can do that. Sesshin can light a fire under what is otherwise just a kind of a maintenance level of Zen practice. What we see in ourselves in Sesshin can free us from a kind of attachment to quiet. It can rouse our spirits and remind us of what we have to contend with. Mainly, foreknowledge of our mortality. Here's another one by Dahui. People are backwards. Ignorant of the true self, they pursue things, willingly suffering immeasurable pains in their greed for a little bit of pleasure. In the mornings, before they've opened their eyes and gotten out of bed, when they're still only half awake, their minds are already flying about in confusion, flowing along with random thoughts. Although good and bad deeds have not yet appeared, heaven and hell are already formed in their hearts before they even get out of bed. By the time they go into action, the seeds of heaven and hell are already implanted in their minds. Heaven and hell being pleasure and displeasure, basically. Pleasure and pain. Suffering immeasurable pains in their greed for a little bit of pleasure. think the reason that we human beings are so, we crave pleasure so much, even though rationally we know that it has a backside to it, a flip side, the reason we will still pursue pleasure is because we don't really know that the other side of the coin is pain. If we are investing our energy in maximizing pleasure for ourselves, then we will suffer. It's just a consequence of it, because there's no way to sustain it forever. Yes, we may be able to succeed in finding pleasure, but it won't last. And then the pain is that much worse, because we become attached to the pleasure. Recently I was reading a sutra and came across a word I'd never heard of, Ichantika. And the glossary said it's some old Buddhist concept, one who cannot reach Buddhahood because of his or her attachment to pleasure, sense pleasure. Of course, that one who is attached, so deeply caught in sense pleasures, is not a permanent one. We always, always have the chance to change, to redirect our energies and find a way that offers a more lasting peace of mind than just these temporary harbors of pleasure. I'm sure many people can relate to this scenario that he paints here. In the mornings, before they've opened their eyes and gotten out of bed, when they're still only half awake, their minds are already flying about in confusion, flowing along with random thoughts. We wake up, the mind engages, and thoughts start flowing. The Buddha said, he's quoting the Buddha, all faculties of sense are receptacles manifested by your own mind. Physical bodies are manifestations of your own mind's representations of forms as subjectively imagined. Boy, that's a long sentence. These manifestations are like the flow of a river, like seeds, like a lamp, like wind, passing away from instant to instant. Frenetic activity, attraction to impure things, and voracity are the causes of the useless, deceptive habits that seem to have always existed, like a water wheel always turning. The useless, deceptive habits that seem to have always existed, like a water wheel always turning. And the engine of this water wheel is our wanting, our craving, our desires, our grasping. Sometimes people ask, well, isn't even the desire for awakening, isn't that a desire too? And the answer is yes, but it's not of the same order as desire, the many countless kinds of desires we have that are self-centered. The desire to come to awakening is different from just wanting to get something for ourselves. It's the desire to do something. And at its best, the desire for awakening is to awaken for the sake of all beings. And even if that isn't in our mind, if we're not thinking about others, still our awakening will benefit all beings. There are two words for at least two, but two that I know of in the original Buddhist language, the Pali language. One is tana, and one is chanda. Tana means craving or thirst, wanting to acquire something for oneself. Whereas chanda is more the desire to do something without the self at the center of it. That's what we want to mobilize in our practice. But it can so easily be misused because the other version, the less evolved version, is to want to get awakened, to get awakening for oneself. Roshi Kaplow said that when he went to Japan, he just wanted to grab Kensho and run. But then, through many, many sesshins, years of practice, that original self-centered desire becomes purified until we slowly dawns on us, usually it's slowly, it dawns on us that so long as others are suffering, that whatever we get is just not going to be enough. That we have to do this practice for all beings, for the greater good, so that we can become vehicles of service, of helping others, and that anything less than that is just can't be satisfying. It can't be satisfying. And then he continues, if you really see through this, that is this, our bondage to the wheel of suffering that's caused by our craving, if you really see through this, you know that heaven and hell are nowhere else but in the heart of the half-awake individual about to get out of bed. They do not come from outside. It's such a limited notion to imagine that heaven and hell are somewhere else, that they're a place that we can go to. We create our heavens and hells by either using our minds intelligently or misusing them. Practice, Zen practice, is a way of gradually training ourselves in the proper use of the mind, which really means the use of our attention, the way we direct our attention. We have a choice moment by moment whether to be involved with our thoughts or be involved the dwelling in this realm of no mind, the breath or the koan, which is beyond thought. That's our choice. That choice, the choice that we make moment by moment, consigns us either to heaven or to hell. He continues, while in the process of waking up, you should really pay attention. While you are paying attention, you should not make any effort to struggle with whatever is going on in your mind. While struggling, you waste energy. as the third ancestor of Zen said, attempts to stop activity will fill you with activity. That, of course, is from Affirming Faith in Mind. Well, but back to this wasting energy. While struggling, you waste energy. It's a waste of energy because we're working against ourselves. But over time, we learn how to work. It doesn't involve judging ourselves, criticizing ourselves. That's a big part of how people start off in practice, finding fault with themselves, getting frustrated. That's the waste of energy. But simply to return the mind again and again and again and again and again to the breath, to the koan, is a way of refining our energy and the way we use it, and conserving energy. We have a lot more energy available to us when we're not spending it fighting or fleeing our thoughts. That's not practice. That's not Zen practice. It's nothing we need to do with our thoughts. We certainly don't need to fight them, nor do we need to flee them. We just need to notice them and then return our attention to the practice we're working on. And then finally he says, when you notice that you are saving energy in the midst of the mundane stress of daily affairs, this is where you gain energy. This is where you attain Buddhahood. This is where you turn hell into heaven. Is a very short one. He says, when you have even a single thought of looking for a shortcut in Zen, you've already stuck your head in a bowl of glue. Why is that? It's because we are caught in time. If we're looking for a shortcut, we are concerned with time. And that is a sure way to impede ourselves, to hinder our progress. We have to forget time while still working strongly with commitment, but without concerns about time. It's another fairly common question I get from beginners is, well, I know you can't say exactly, but how long would you say, you know, the rest? People have been used by the mind's conceptual consciousness since before they can remember, flowing in the waves of birth and death, unable to be independent. If they want to leave birth and death to be joyfully alive, they must cut through decisively, stopping the course of mind's conceptual consciousness. Birth and death is just another, kind of a conventional Buddhist way of referring to change, the world of change, the world of suffering. Because a lot of suffering really just comes through change. Not change itself, but our resistance to change, our attachment to wanting to have things stay the same. And then when they don't, when they change, when we lose someone close to us, when we break up in a relationship, when our job changes, when our health changes, because of our attachment to the way we want things to be, our preferences, then we suffer. That's really what he's talking about when he says birth and death. I like this use of, his use of the word used. People have been used by the mind's conceptual consciousness. There's nothing wrong with this amazing computer we have in our skulls. There's nothing wrong with planning and evaluating at times, analyzing, discriminating, classifying, categorizing, even judging. We need good judgment at times. People with bad judgment suffer themselves. There's nothing wrong with using this tremendous endowment we have. But the real problem comes when we're used by it, when we cannot stop it, when we're pitched around all the time by this restless mind that cannot fall silent. When we're used by concepts, words and concepts. Words and concepts are useful, but then when we're used by them, which means attached to them, that's when we suffer. And one final entry here. He quotes the Buddha that when the mind does not grasp things of the past, does not long for things of the future, and does not dwell on things of the present, then one realizes that past, present, and future are empty. That is, they have no substance to them. They're just concepts, past, present, and future. He says, don't think about past events, whether good or bad, for if you think about them, this impedes the way. Don't calculate future matters, for if you calculate, you go mad. Don't fix your attention on present affairs, whether unpleasant or pleasant, for if you fix your attention on them, they will disturb your mind. Just deal with situations as they happen, and you will spontaneously accord with the way. Deal with situations. Respond. Just respond. And we can't fully respond or properly respond if we're caught in any of these concepts, past, future, or present. We only can be fully alive and responsive when we are unattached to past, present, and future. Notice when he says, don't fix your attention on present affairs, he means there too don't get caught in ideas about what's happening right now. But instead, flow with, move along with things, with change as it happens. Well, this is a very difficult thing for most people. This level of non-attachment, that we can just float along with things like a gourd on water. But it happens. It gets easier. We find ourselves doing it little by little. We catch ourselves letting go more easily, moving along with change, moving with things, circumstances. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.